The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon. I'm Claudio Grossman, the Dean of the Washington College of Law. As a human rights lawyer, I know firsthand the power of images that show the uncompromised truth. We just had a hearing before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and we used film material to put the case very strongly concerning the suffering that is inflicted in family members of disappeared persons. The Human Rights Film Festival that our school sponsors each year with the School of Communication Center for Social Media demonstrate the importance of documentary filmmaking in the struggle for justice, in a general sense of socializing and educating and reflecting important values of dignity for the society and the world at large. Freeing filmmakers from unnecessary burdens of copyright compliance will help assure that more influential documentaries are made and seen. And that is the goal of the Untold Stories project, which today celebrates the completion of an important phase. So it's a goal very valuable from the point of view of the society in general and from the point of view of advocacy and human rights before courts, as you cannot imagine. Our school is committed to supporting scholarship that makes a difference in the world and to promoting interdisciplinary cooperation. So I am happy to note the collaboration between the Center for Social Media and the WCL Program on Intellectual Property and the Public Interest, from which the statement of best practices that is being released here grows, as well as the generous support of the Rockefeller and MacArthur Foundations that has made this work possible. I welcome the faculty and students, the distinguished filmmakers, and the members of the press who are in attendance. I want to thank also the director of our intellectual property program, Professor Peter Yassi, with whose leadership has been not only essential, is the reason why we are here, and the reason of the interdisciplinary effort from the side of our school. Without his leadership, the law school would not have done this program. So thank you, Peter, for your contribution. It is also my special pleasure to introduce Dean Larry Kierman of the School of Communication. The appointment of Dean Kierman was good news for the School of Communications and for all of us. His integrity, his intelligence, and really his analytical powers of persuasion have made a tremendous difference in the meetings of the deans. So we have benefited from his presence in this university from in every aspect that you can imagine. So we are honored to team with him and his school in this important action. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Claudio. This collaboration reflects our shared values. It is driven by our commitments to human rights and social justice. Since I'm in the law school, I'll make a citation, the UN Declaration of Human Rights on Human Rights, Article 19. The question we've asked here is, how do we create an enabling environment for the media we need in a strong democracy? Center for Social Media and the Program on Intellectual Property and the Public Interest identified the problems that documentary makers face, did the research to find solutions, and organized the filmmakers and their public media distributors around a set of specific and achievable remedies. For that, I want to thank the MacArthur and Rockefeller Foundations for the sustained resources to build this initiative. It is rare to have the ongoing support that gets you all the way from study to implementation. And I want to honor the independent filmmakers and the distribution and outreach organizations that have joined this effort. They represent generations of media rights activists who have engaged in the struggles to shape government and corporate communication policies in the public interest. It's wonderful to see filmmakers, artists, who are committed to the larger social good and to the standards and ethics of their profession. In all this work, it's my great pleasure to be a collaborator with Pat Ofterheide in the School of Communication. As a leading documentary film critic and historian, Pat raises expectations for the field in her teaching, research, and writing. Under her direction, the Center's public media think tank is mapping the landscape for the future of public broadcasting in the United States. Untold Stories is an important step in helping to anticipate and shape the public media environment we want to live in and work in. And I think that's the work we have in front of us today. Thank you, Pat.
I have so many thank yous, not only to this institution and to the Rockefeller and MacArthur Foundations, which have consistently helped us over the 3 years to evolve this project, but also to many people in this room. There are people in this room who have made films and who help other people make films and who teach people to make films, all of whom helped to build this project. So I want to send a thank you to all of you. The statement that you, I hope, picked up a copy of, and I hope you pick up more copies of on the way home and give lots of them to your friends, it's an end result of a question that Professor Peter Yazzie and I had, which is, how do the demands to pay copyright holders for every quotation, how do those demands affect the creative work of filmmakers? We were less concerned, actually, about dollar figures and much more concerned about the imagination. What happens to what people think can be said in their society if they are only permitted to quote what other people will let them quote under the price that they will let them quote it for? The people we wanted to ask this question of were documentary filmmakers. They are leaders of free speech in this society, and they also are copyright holders, and they are copyright holders who use copyrighted material all the time in their work. In a study we completed last year and released in this very space, we found that documentarians pay an extremely high creative price at this point in history for the situation they're in with copyright. They pay high monetary costs, which we actually already knew, and then we know that that means that many good projects simply cannot be made. We also found out that they regularly change, alter, and even fake reality because they cannot afford to pay the copyright clearance costs of the music that is playing in the background or the show that is on the television, and they really, really hope that nobody ever sings Happy Birthday. Okay, and then they watch their works go out of circulation because the rental prices, their rental times have run out and they can't renew them. But the worst thing we found is that they just plain decide, and increasingly decide, not to make certain kinds of work. Cultural criticism, ouch, you'd have to quote popular music and film. Media criticism, ditto. Historical films, ooh, all rights clearance all the way down. Music documentaries, don't even think about the layers of rights. So when we looked at those problems, we found that one of the many problems they had in copyright clearance, but a big problem, was not being able to use fair use. And fair use is part of the copyright law that lets people quote copyrighted material without permission and without payment under certain circumstances. And people use it all the time. Journalists use it without even thinking, print journalists, news broadcasters, I use it every day and invoke it freely. Historians use it and they don't even know they're using it. But documentarians weren't using it. Why? Because they hadn't defined what they think is fair and reasonable. They are the artists. They're the ones, they're the professionals. They're the copyright holders who know what they think is the limit of appropriate if somebody's going to borrow material from them. So they're the people who have to decide in fair use what's fair and reasonable, just like historians decided for themselves, just like news broadcasters decided for themselves. And that's where the research took us last year. And it led us into the project that we are now releasing, in which my colleague Peter Yazzie will now discuss.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you, Deans Grossman and Kirkman. This has been an extraordinary journey, and with us here today are many individuals who have gone along the way with us, and thank you to all of you as well. As Pat mentioned, filmmakers often feel constrained by copyright, but in the first round of conversations that we had
with members of this community, we discovered something else as well, and that is that sometimes documentary filmmakers do take advantage of fair use. The problem, we thought, was that these invocations of fair use were too few, sometimes too timid, and almost always too private. Now, fair use is the jewel in the crown of American copyright law. It is an engine of progress, and it is, in particular, a doctrine that cares directly for notions of public good and public benefit. To boil it down into a tiny, brief summary, fair use is a doctrine that says that sometimes unauthorized uses of copyrighted material should be permitted rather than prevented, and that is when the public benefit that flows from those uses outweighs the private costs that those uses impose. It's an ideal tool for documentary filmmakers, because as courts have recently confirmed, there are always two major questions that come up in a fair use analysis. One is whether the amount of material that the user took is limited and appropriate to the purpose, and the other, of course, is whether or not the user added significant value to the material that was taken. And if you think about documentary practice, almost every example of quotation from pre-existing media that occurs on a regular basis in documentary practice fits neatly under those two criteria. There's one other thing, though, that courts also look at in these cases, and that's whether the use was reasonable and undertaken in good faith. And that's where this idea of a statement of best practices comes in. This statement, we hope, is going to be evidence of what the community of documentary filmmakers represented by their national organizations, from whom you'll be hearing shortly, believes is reasonable and balanced in a number of recurrent situations that we identified in our group interviews over the course of the last 18 months. Let me just read to you the headings of the statement of best principles, the four kinds of recurrent situations to which it is addressed. One is employing copyrighted material as the object of social, political, or cultural critique. Another, the second, is quoting copyrighted works of popular culture to illustrate an argument or point. The third is capturing copyrighted media content in the process of filming something else. And the fourth is using copyrighted material in a historical sequence. Now, to each of these recurrent situations, the statement is addressed, and it addresses itself by stating first a broader conclusion that fair use is applicable in these situations, and then by providing some limiting principles that were hammered out in our discussions with filmmakers over the course of many wonderful conversations. So let me illustrate. Let me go now to the third of those principles and read you a little more. This was capturing copyrighted media content in the process of filming something else. And the principle the statement articulates is that fair use should protect documentary filmmakers from being forced to falsify reality where a sound or image has been captured incidentally and without prevision as part of an unstaged scene. It should be permissible to use it in the final version of the film. And then we state some guiding or qualifying principles that documentarians should take care that particular media content played or displayed in a scene was not requested or directed by them, that incidentally captured media content included in the final version of the film is integral to the action, that the content is properly attributed, that the scene has not been included primarily to exploit the incidentally captured content in its own right, and in the case of music, that the content does not function as a substitute for a sync track. The articulation in the statement is a bit longer than that, but those are the essential points, and that gives you a sense of how each of the principles in the statement is set forth and is designed to function. Now, we're happy to say that as of this morning, we also have some web resources that are designed to help illustrate and exemplify the statements or the conclusions of the statement. And I wanted to show you one of those as it relates to the third principle that I mentioned a moment ago. So let's go to the example. Thank you. There are many similar examples and other, we hope, useful resources to be found at the website, which we'd very much encourage you to visit. And, of course, some of the examples that you'll see on the website, as are some of the, or many even, of the real-life instances that filmmakers encounter, are going to be hybrids of the several categories that the statement describes. We hope that the statement will be no less useful for that purpose. There's also one other thing that I want to say about the statement. It's in the text, but it's very important to emphasize, and that is the statement isn't designed in any way to exhaust the field of fair use as it applies to documentary filmmakers. There are obviously going to be other more unusual or less frequently recurrent instances in documentary practice to which the fair use principle also will apply. What the statement tries to do is to pick up on the most common, the most recurrent, and for many practitioners, the most problematic ones. Pat and I worked on the statement, but the real work was done by the filmmakers themselves, who were so generous in spending time to talk with us. It was they, not us, who hammered out the various compromises between proprietary rights and user access that the statement reflects. And in particular, we want to congratulate the five filmmakers organizations who were instrumental in this process and have now lent their names to it for their accomplishments in the completion of this remarkable process. We look forward to working with them and others in the future to publicize the statement in film and law schools and beyond. And again, we owe them, as does, I think, the whole community of documentary filmmakers, a tremendous debt of gratitude.
We've just received, actually, some good news that will allow us to continue to be able to work with these organizations and others, because the MacArthur Foundation has agreed to fund continuing work in distributing the statement with filmmaker organizations, with programmers, producers, distributors, and other gatekeepers. As well, the Rockefeller Foundation has agreed to continue to fund this team to work with educational communities to develop curriculum materials and also to pilot a legal clinic program so that filmmakers who read this statement will have somebody to call when they say, but does this really apply to me? We would like now to turn to the filmmaker organizations, because it is they ultimately who are the collective authors of this document. Jack Walsh will be our first speaker.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you, Peter. It's a great honor for me to be here as a member of this team who put the document together. I am the co-director of the National Alliance for Media Arts and Culture. And for those of you who are unaware of what that is, we are the National Arts Service Organization for the Media Arts. And we define media arts as motion media, so anyone working in film, video, or digital, moving images, as well as audio. What we do primarily is leadership development, capacity building, and original research. And this particular project actually came to our attention on the heels of a project we had done the year before called Deep Focus, the Future of Independent Media. And what became very apparent to us as an organization was that the use of copyrighted materials is going to become more and more the issue as we move forward in a digital world where people are looking to appropriate and to use material to quote it, and that there really wasn't a strong basis for people to have access to material. The law was there, but there was no like clear guidelines and situations that were brought up. And that's what this document really does present. And I think that's really the true value of it. It really brings fair use back into a larger discourse about what it means to quote material, who has ownership, what the rights of ownership are, and what is really important in a free society for an exchange of ideas. NAMAC's role in this is quite different than my other colleagues here who represent makers, in that we represent organizations, and our organizations include distributors, exhibitors, film festivals, broadcasters, cable outlets, and now in the new environment, web broadcasters, who really need to be aware of this. We know that some of the gatekeepers that filmmakers are hitting all the time are programmers at public television stations, public access stations who don't know if they're allowed to show certain material or not because they don't really understand fair use. So actually our role as an organization in this project, we'll be getting that out to organizations. We'll be doing that through a number of publications we have. One's a web-based publication. The other is a newsletter. And then in March, along with the center, we're going to be hosting an online salon for the member organizations that Pat and Peter have generously agreed to participate in. I don't think they quite understand the time attached to it, to basically engage with the issues that come up for our constituents about it, because I think there will be a lot of debate with this document being released today. Thank you.
And now Simon Tarr, who is the chairman of the board of directors of the Association of Independent Video and Filmmakers.
Hi. AIVF represents independent filmmakers from all genres, not just documentary, in the United States. And we publish a magazine called The Independent Film and Video Monthly, in addition to providing services and information and connections for independent filmmakers everywhere. And we are absolutely thrilled to be a part of this really groundbreaking document. Copyright is enshrined in the Constitution, and it deserves protection. And the people who make work deserve to have their intellectual property, so to speak, protected. At the same time, a free society really does require media makers and makers of culture to be able to build upon what has come before. And not just that, but to do it in a reasonable and common sense and concise way. This is pretty concise. And it's very clear. And this is what the independent film community has been needing for a long time. Current makers and emerging makers needed a concise, clear guide to fair use, what it really is, what it means to them, not just when they're done editing and when they're about to check with a lawyer, but most importantly, as they're in the process of ideation, they're starting their concept, and they need this information before the self-censorship happens, before the editing happens during their ideas. And for that reason, this is so important, and we're just tremendously happy to be a part of this. We're going to do, at AIVF, we're looking forward to doing everything we can to get the word out to our 5,000 plus members, and beyond that, and getting it to independent filmmakers everywhere. Through our magazine, The Independent, through our website, and through programs that we give across the country. So again, I just want to say thanks for doing this, and this is just a great document.
And now we have two representatives from the International Documentary Association. The first speaker will be Michael Donaldson, who is on the board and is the general counsel of IDEA, and also the author of the leading book on copyright law, which students learn from, and the title is?
Clearance and Copyright.
Clearance and Copyright.
Little did I know we'd get to plug product here. This is great. This is truly a glorious day for filmmakers, because this nagging problem finally has been, the filmmakers have taken charge of their own destiny and created this statement, with the help and guidance of Peter and Pat. Fair use is it's the lubricant that makes the copyright law and the freedom of expression somehow work together. Those two elements of the Constitution would clash without fair use. And this statement, when it's presented to the various people that have yay or nay authority in this world, will help educate them, and instead of being a best practice, it'll be the general practice. Right now, this statement of fair use complies with the law, and in my practice, in my law practice, every week there are dozens of clips where I say to the filmmaker, this is fair use. But the gatekeepers, the people who are in charge of being sure they don't get sued, the insurance companies, are unwilling to take that risk. This statement is a giant leap to making generally accepted
what is now the best practice. Now our executive director, Sandra Rusch, can tell us what IDEA is going to do about it.
First, I just want to kiss this document. And Michael, too. Because we're a nonprofit organization, and we have 2,700 members in 50 countries in the world. We are devoted exclusively to the nonfiction genre. And I would say two questions that I'm asked constantly on a daily basis. One, where can I get my film distributed? Two, can you talk to me about this clip I used? Is it fair use or not? And that's when I panic. The first one I can handle somewhat. But the second question is when I say, do you have a lawyer? Or have you read clearance and copyright? And now, for the first time, I'll be able to say there is something that you can read. I don't have to try to answer those questions because we are a service organization and we want to help the filmmakers in every way we can possibly. So as an organization, we will, of course, run the entire best statement in our magazine. We will have it on our website. We will have e-blasts. We will have in our e-newsletter, and we will make it part of our continuing series, which we do every year on documentary seminars from Docs A to Z. We do this in LA, and we'd like now to try to do it in various other cities with the help of these organizations. And I would think down the road, even though I haven't discussed this with the board yet, it would be lovely if we could include some sort of an award every year to recognize a filmmaker who has an outstanding achievement in the use of fair use. So that's something that I would like to look forward to and have the board agree to. And so now that it's on tape, maybe we have a chance. So we are thrilled. Thank you, everybody, for all the work you've done. You've helped me and the 2,700 members and anyone else who goes to www.documentary.org, which seems to be Doc Central. Okay, thank you so much.
And the fifth organization that was involved in creating this document, Women in Film and Video, the DC chapter, Representative Laura Paseski.
Good afternoon. Women in Film and Video is a nonprofit membership organization that provides educational activities and programs for women and men in the film and television industry. The DC chapter does that for folks in the DC metropolitan area, but we also have several sister organizations throughout the country and even throughout the world. On behalf of Women in Film, I just want to let you all know how excited we are about this project, and we really want to thank Peter and you, Pat, for all of your hard work on this project. It's very incredible. Because DC is one of the top nonfiction markets for film production, most, if not all, of our 1,000 members are confronted with rights clearances issues on a daily basis. We view these guidelines as important, as an important initiative to shaping and securing the future of documentary filmmaking. Many of our members have already personally participated in this project and look forward to an ongoing participation in it. For our members and all professionals in this industry, the lack of clarity and fair use standards has tremendously impaired documentary film production by limiting artistic expression and silencing narratives on important social and cultural and political issues. In an economic climate where producers and filmmakers are confronted with shrinking budgets and are routinely asked to absorb all the legal liability risks involved with film production, the impact of unclear fair use standards is even more acute. Personally, as a legal representative to many of these filmmakers, I know firsthand the often agonizing process of determining how much risk to take on in order to keep a high-impact scene or artistically important moment. Documentarians are regularly sacrificing stories and their art because they are concerned that not having permission for content would open them up to a threat of a lawsuit, even in situations where fair use would clearly absolve them of liability. Because of the profound impact these issues have had on the artistic and economic choices of filmmakers, we welcome the best practices and fair use guidelines as a glimmer of hope to achieve clarity in a legal pandemic that has slowly drained the life and livelihood out of the documentary voice. We look forward to taking part in encouraging dialogue between rights holders and content users. And it is our conviction that this initiative become a starting point for an industry-wide standards on fair use issues. I personally extend to you as a member of WIF our thanks for having this vision to develop this project and the determination to see it through. It's an honor to be a part of it, and we look forward to an ongoing cooperation moving forward. Thank you.
And I think we're going to borrow that phrase, legal pandemic. We love that.
You have fair use. Go right ahead.
Well, thank you all so very much. We'd like to now turn to our filmmaker panel. So we're going to switch people and their name tags. We asked a number of people to come and speak to you today, although we could have asked so many more in the filmmaking community. We begin with, could you please come up, filmmakers? We begin our comments with George Stoney, who's our oldest member of the group. George is one of our godfathers of the documentary movement. And we will end with one of our emerging makers who is still in the process of making his first feature film. And so I'd like to turn first to George Stoney.
Well, it may be a great day for the filmmakers, but it's also a great day for the public, because the public is getting the message from a great many people who translate it, rather than from a few corporate people who can put out the cable, potted history on the cable, and can have the attorneys to clear this. Two examples. A few years ago, I was making a film about the uprising of 34, the textile strike at the South, and we were looking for stills. We found that the Bettman archive and the other archives had gone around and collected all the stills from the papers when they were sold over to the chains. $50 a pot, come back to New York, $50 a $20 a pot to have any printed up, $250 for public rates, for public broadcasting rights, another $250 for general rights. We actually found a print, a glossy print with a woman's name on the back of it. She was standing in a relief line with a baby on her arm and her sister and the other thing. We've traced her, we found her. She didn't have a picture of her own baby. And that was, it was illegal for us to give her a picture. Of course, we did. But who has a right to that? Was the photographer, the photographer has long since forgotten. It's just drifted in the hands of Bettman Archives, which is now a part of another corporation, which is a blip on the stock market. Who owns our history?
I'd like to turn now to the Academy Award-winning Geraldine Wurtzberg, known to many of us as Jerry.
Can I just sit here?
Works okay for me.
This is really a very important moment for us as filmmakers, and when they said you can kind of make some brief remarks, obviously I want to thank Pat and Peter, because this is like, there are many things I've had to leave out in films that I would love to put back in. But I kind of wanted to give you kind of a perspective as a filmmaker that in 1971 I did my first film that was at the Berlin Film Festival, and it was about my mother, and I had no fair use issues. So then you kind of fast forward, and I did a lot of other films in between. Then I was working on a film for George Lucas, and he's a man who has several buildings filled with lawyers. And so a simple Texas two-step scene turned into a Foley session in Skywalker Ranch, because we couldn't use that Texas two-step, and we did public domain. And then finally, the latest film that I was nominated for, Autism is a World, the woman that the whole film is about is a great lover of Clint Black, but every time she'd get in the car, I'd turn that sound off. And so this was such an important part of her. And so I guess I'm going to have to go back now and retract the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jerry. Now we're turning to John Sorensen. John Sorensen works for New River Media and is also a graduate of this program. And when was part of the team that brainstormed the terms of this and really sort of had a new awakening about what was possible here.
Yeah, this is kind of my road to Damascus. When I first started in working in documentary, I was working primarily for cable distributors. And I was taught as a young PA and as an associate producer and as a researcher and then as a producer to completely see the world of filmmaking through the lens of what was my rights window. It became, you know, very kind of myopic in a sense. And so I wouldn't even pick something up. I wouldn't take the plastic wrapper off of it unless I knew, you know, that I could acquire the rights to it. And so it was a very deadening kind of way to interact with subject matter. And I think, you know, it's hurt the material that I make. And I think it hurts the entire documentary industry. It kind of applies this kind of blandening to our culture to, you know, have to resort to you know, needle drop music and have to, you know, sanitize reality to turn off the radio and take things out of the background or to not use that scene or whatever, simply because there's not the money to cover it or there's no time. There's no time to fight those battles necessarily. And so I think what this report does for me is, quite frankly, it creates more work for me, but in a good way. It makes me take a second look to try and break out of my box and say, okay, is there a way that I can that this is appropriate in a fair use environment that's going to enhance the material, enhance the subject, and make it a better film. And so I'm really excited about this, and being involved with this process and talking with other documentary filmmakers has been a great kind of awakening for me in terms of seeing that we all are, you know, share these same issues, and we all just want to tell good stories, real stories that matter and have an impact for our viewers.
You saw some of the work of Gordon Quinn moments ago when we showed you one of the clips. Because Gordon's organization, which he helped to found, Cartemquin Films, made the seven-part series New Americans, of which we showed one problem. Gordon Quinn is an example of a filmmaker who in the past was able to use fair use to a much greater degree. And has seen that change and has been part of the process of shifting it back again. Gordon Quinn.
One of the most exciting things to me about what Pat and Peter have done with this project is I know a great number of people in this room and across the country who've been working on this issue, but we're all struggling in isolation. And they've brought us together. And that was just, they brought us together with something to do. Letting us know that we can really change this reality. The irony of the clip that you saw, which is an incredible piece of film, this new immigrant, he's whistling this George Strait song, and then he looks over and he sees a guy looking on a motorcycle, giving him a hostile look. We actually changed that for the final release on PBS because we could not get the gatekeepers to accept it. You can be sure now that when I release it on DVD, I'm going to put the original soundtrack back in. I'm one of the people who, when we did Hoop Dreams, paid $5,000 because Arthur's family insisted on singing him Happy Birthday with the cake and the candles and everything burning there. And I think, you know, this, for our field, and other people have spoken to this, Larry Kirkman spoke to it, it's the philosophic underpinnings for this are at the core of what we do. We make these films because we are participating in the democratic process of our country. I love one of the lawyers who said to me, nobody owns history. We have to push back around these issues. It's not just an economic issue. It's an issue that's vital to how we communicate with each other as citizens.
Thank you. And Byron Hurt, we first met each other actually at the Virginia Film Festival, where Byron presented some of his work in progress beyond Beats and Rhymes. And I'd like to ask you to tell people a little bit about that and its relevance to this issue.
Well, first, I think I must have died and gone to independent filmmaker heaven because I just happened to be coming along at a time where the type of films that I like to create, films that deal with issues surrounding race, class, and gender in popular culture, makes it, you know, best practices makes it much easier for me to do that and feel comfortable. I'm almost certain that many of the gray hairs that are lining my beard are a direct result of many nights of going to sleep wondering if the fair use police were gonna come after me and arrest me and beat me down Rodney King style because I used copyrighted material that I didn't pay for. So I'm very happy and feel very privileged to be a part of a group of filmmakers that are here to discuss this issue. My documentary film is called Beyond Beats and Rhymes, Masculinity in Rap Music and Hip Hop Culture. And the film basically deconstructs the representations of manhood in rap music and hip hop culture, focusing in on hypermasculinity, male posturing, bravado, misogyny, sexism, and homophobia that exists in much of the mainstream popular culture that we see in mainstream music television and mainstream radio stations. But it was important for me to tell that story. It was important for me to be able to draw on those representations, the visual representations that you see in popular culture, and have social critics, hip-hop writers, historians, and other people speak directly to those images. And the only way that I could do that was to show them. Now, because I'm an independent documentary filmmaker with very limited resources, it was almost prohibitive for me to do that. And so I have to rely on fair use as a defense. So my executive producer, Stanley Nelson, really strongly encouraged me to make the film that I wanted to make and not self-censor myself, but make the film that I want to make and then deal with the fair use issues later, which is what I did. And I was lucky enough to get a lawyer who was going to go to bat for me and to support me using fair use as a defense. But this document is critical for filmmakers like myself and other filmmakers who don't have a lot of money but have very important stories to tell. And for someone like myself personally who is coming up at a time where media culture is so huge, corporations are so big and are so fewer, and it's more difficult to get access to this stuff without having to pay a whole lot of money for it. It's critical to have a document like this in place. And I'm just very happy. I'm going to take as many of these documents as possible and share them with my filmmaker friends and people, because I think that there's a certain level of anxiety and fear that a lot of filmmakers have in terms of, you know, when and how we can apply fair use. So this makes me feel better. It makes me feel that I have a support. It makes me feel like there's a template in place for filmmakers to draw from. And I'm just ecstatic about it. And like I said, I feel like I'm viewing the world from above now because I can continue making the films that I want to make.
I would like to also thank the other filmmakers who are in the room, and there are many of you, who are also participated in this and who know what it was like to sit in the meetings. We held meetings across the country organized by these five organizations. And in these meetings, the kind of emotions that you're hearing in the voices of these filmmakers came up. And we actually saw two very distinct but intense emotional reactions in these meetings. And one was relief and delight. Oh my God, I could do that. And the other one was anger. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, they've been keeping me from doing that. And it was my right all along. And one of the things that I think people haven't raised in this filmmaker panel that I'd like to raise in Q&A, if you like, is the fact that each one of these people who is finding their ability to use fair use liberating is also a copyright holder who wants the respect given to a copyright holder and has discovered in developing the terms of that statement the middle ground where respect lies for material. So I want to thank all of the filmmakers on this panel. We're going to switch now to our last panel, which will, and after those remarks, we will have a chance for your comments and questions. The first organizations that we went to, the first people we went to were the heads of organizations, and we asked them for their collaboration and their assistance in locating the veteran producers who had enough season and experience to know the world of copyright clearance. The second people, group of people that we went to were the filmmakers themselves when we had the meeting. The third group of people we went to were people who we thought would be in a position to put a stamp of approval and be able to put this statement to use. And so this panel of people are people who are in one sense or another gatekeepers and educators. And I'd like to start with Tamara Gould from the Independent Television Service, which is part of our American Public Broadcasting.
Thank you, Pat and Peter, for having me, and also for this phenomenal work that you have done. I can't tell you strongly enough how much we will use this and how much the filmmakers that we work with every day will use this. ITVS, for the last 15 years, has supported over 500 documentaries and fiction films that have gone on to PBS. Both veteran and new filmmakers, you know, every day we're dealing with issues of fair use and what's possible to use in broadcasting. And I think the more educated we can be, the more educated our filmmakers can be. What I'm so excited about today is not only who's in the room and who's a part of this, but also who will be in the room and who will be a part of this, and how we can finally use this issue, which I think we can say as a field has caused us so much consternation and so much confusion for so long. And we're so grateful that you have brought some leadership to this issue and really helped organize us and organize our thinking so that we can actually really take a stronger stand and defend our rights as filmmakers and filmmaking organizations. So thank you.
We were very, very grateful to the Independent Television Service for its interest in this area, because the Independent Television Service is a leading producer, co-producer of social documentaries in the United States. We were also really thrilled to discover that the major strand that showcases independent social documentary in the United States, the series, for those of you who are not in public TV, within public TV they call it a strand, it is POV, point for point of view. And we are really delighted that Simon Kilmurray, the chief operating officer of POV, is here today. I hope all of you are watching both Independent Lens and POV.
Thank you, Pat and Peter, for inviting me to be here today, and thank you so much for your tremendously hard work that you've put into this. For the past 18 years, POV has presented some of the best independent documentary films on PBS. We presented over 200 social issue documentary films. I had an interesting interaction with one of what we call the gatekeepers, a person working for the insurance industry, a couple of months ago, when we were talking about a film and a filmmaker who had not cleared rights for a clip that she was intending to use was claiming fair use on it, and the insurance industry representative, who shall remain nameless, said, "Well, we don't really like fair use. That raises our risk, and we see fair use as a defense." And I think this is really the first step where we're moving away from that idea of fair use being a defense, that fair use is a right, and that filmmakers need to be able to exercise that right to be able to tell the stories, the critical stories around social issues that we need them to tell, so that people are aware of what's going on in our world. We at POV really view this as the beginning of a process. This is a process now of education, of educating the insurance industries, the gatekeepers, the broadcasters, and producers. And we think that this document, with that education, will become the gold standard for that perennial question which we get from filmmakers: is this fair use, or do I have to license it? This will give us a reference for that, and we look forward to being an integral part of that education process.
Thank you, Simon, and believe me, the work that gatekeepers like yourself do in educating people on either end, both the filmmakers and the insurers, will be absolutely critical. I'd like now to turn to Professor Carla Berry, who is the president of the University Film and Video Association, the major professional association for teachers of film and video in higher ed.
Thank you, Pat. Well, since the 1940s, the University Film and Video Association has been committed to both film scholarship and film practice. Thank you. I usually don't have a problem speaking up. And so we are delighted to be a part of this project because our membership represent the next generation. We're responsible for the next generation of filmmakers, and now we have a really handy guide that we can give to our students, and we can give them the correct information so that they can make good decisions as they go on to put this into practice. And I would also like to be the first to announce a film contest. We are partnering with the Center for Social Media. Lena Jaswal from American University will be curating this, coordinating this. And it is fair use and free speech. And it is a contest for films, short films, that employ fair use, and in particular, films made by those in higher education. And so the winners will be announced and screened and awarded at the 60th annual UFVA conference, and I expect to see every one of you there in August at Chapman University in Orange, California. So thank you all for all of this work. It really makes our job a lot easier.
And film students and teachers in the room, please do take advantage of this opportunity to get both this issue and you and your students' work showcased. And finally, Katie Chevigny, who's the CEO of Arts Engine, which is a multifaceted organization. So I would really like to hear, what are those different pieces?
Arts Engine is a nonprofit based in New York that produces, distributes, and promotes independent media. We have a real focus on documentaries, particularly social issue media. Our online program, mediarights.org, connects social issue media to new viewers in innovative and creative ways. We now have 12,000 members across the country. They include filmmakers, educators, librarians, activists, and people who work at nonprofit organizations. We feel that exercising fair use is critically important to the future of documentary filmmaking, as many people here have said today. And to our society at large as well. We're delighted to support this effort. We've been involved in it since the beginning. I want to echo the enthusiasm people felt earlier about just hearing the news that things could be different for all of us. In order to spread the word of the Statement of Best Practices of Fair Use, Arts Engine is announcing a new prize for filmmakers who employ fair use. In the spring of 2006, as part of our sixth annual Media That Matters Film Festival, we're going to give a cash award to a film that exemplifies these best practices. This jury-selected film will also receive distribution through our festival DVD and the online streaming on our website. Historically, this has been a problem for us in the festival, and we have, in fact, as many people have stated, decided to censor ourselves and not include certain films in the festival because they were going to stream online, and we were concerned about, this is a whole other side of the censorship we were afraid of, because it was going to be online, that we would be asked to cease and desist actually having it there. So we're going to change it with this particular award. This new prize is our way of calling attention to fair use, especially for emerging filmmakers, many of whom have not heard about this before. So thanks very much.
Well, we are almost ready for our Q&A. I would love to see people at the microphones. Please do come up and ask your questions and or make your comments. Before we do that, my colleague Peter Yazzie has a couple of comments.
This has been a very, very powerful afternoon for me, and to listen to these testimonies from this range of committed individuals within this unusual and creative community is really very gratifying. And it's gratifying not only because it lends some validation to the work that we have been doing for the last couple of years, but also because it suggests something about the way ahead. And I want to say a word about that, even though it isn't specific now to the concerns of the documentary filmmaking community. Documentarians are not the only group of creators in our society who struggle with the same kinds of problems that, or with the kinds of problems that have been described today. as we have gone around talking about these issues in various fora, we've heard similar things from artists, from historians, from practitioners in almost every area of information practice. And it's our hope that we may, in helping the community of documentary filmmakers to come together and to author this statement by which they themselves are reclaiming copyright for creativity, we may also have offered a model that others will follow. And it would please me very much, and I know it would please Pat very much, if in years to come, in the next few years, in fact, we were to see other information practice communities come together in the way that the documentary filmmakers have done to come to consensus about their own shared vision of fair use. So perhaps if we meet here again in 5 years, we'll be able to talk not only about the transformation of practice in the field of documentary filmmaking, but also about how the model that is exemplified in the statement that is released today has begun or began the process of rebalancing rights under copyright more generally. So again, I just want to say a word of thanks to all of the filmmakers who made this happen, those who are here today, those who are with us in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, in New York, in Chicago, in Washington, and whose statement this is. Thank you.
Okay, and please tell people who you are.
Hi, I'm Holly Statler with Dreamcatcher Films and also an adjunct teacher here of documentary production. My question is, in the process of everyone you talked with, it's great to see the representatives from PBS, our public broadcasting system here, but how about those commercial outlets? I imagine the lawyers at Discovery and National Geographic and Animal Planet and a lot of the people that are my clients are not going to embrace this, and I'm curious what the feedback has been before you move forward from them.
I think you identify an extremely important issue. I'm not as pessimistic as you are about the ultimate ability of this statement to be persuasive on the various levels of gatekeepers and their lawyers who you identify in your question. The process of making this statement available, of making this statement into the gold standard for fair use in documentary filmmaking is a process that begins today. And it is the challenge that you describe, which is a real challenge, is I think a shared challenge for all of us. This is not something that we can do alone. We all have our own connections and contacts in the world of gatekeepers that you describe, some with the lawyers, some with the people on the creative side, and we all have a responsibility, if this project is going to work, to help to explain it, to disseminate it, to explain it, and to be as convincing as possible about its merits as an approach. The one thing I think is on our side is that of the different entities and the lawyers who represent them that you identify, no one has an interest in bottling up expression. Everyone has an interest in letting expression be as free as we believe the fair use doctrine can make it. The challenge, and it is a challenge which begins today, is to persuade those who often have the ability to say yay or nay to a given project to accept the new vision of copyright clearance that this document exemplifies. Now, in fact, we're not inventing anything here today. We are rediscovering something. We are rediscovering what filmmaker after filmmaker in our conversations told us had been the general practice as recently as 20 years or even 15 years ago. So we've got a challenge ahead of us, but I don't think it's an insuperable challenge if, and I really mean this because it is a shared obligation, we all take it on as our challenge.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Mary Frost, independent filmmaker. And just follow up on what you said, as we move ahead from this day, how are we going to go from this wonderful statement
to these everyday decisions that we're going to have to make of, is this fair use, is this not fair use? Are there places, people that producers on a daily basis could ask? Because most of the lawyers that you talk to don't know about this yet. And that maybe we, I mean, or do we just make a decision to do it and then wait for somebody to sue us? And
oh, I hope not.
So maybe we all should be willing to fund, you know, to be prepared to help fund the if it comes to suits for people.
That's a very interesting question. One of the things that we talked about at the very outset of this project, once we'd identified the problem of the underutilization of fair use in documentary production, was whether or not the more confrontational approach of trying to provoke and then defend lawsuits which could function as test cases was one that we should recommend or pursue. And we turned away from that approach in favor of this one for a couple of different reasons. One is that, in fact, the law of the courts, is very good. The cases in which documentary filmmakers have defended their use of copyrighted material on the basis of fair use, and there are only a small handful of such cases decided over the last few years, are, with one singular and fairly outrageous exception, all decided in favor of the documentary filmmaker. So it wasn't clear to us that test cases were really going to prove anything more than what the courts have already told us, that it was more important to try to translate that information and achieve consensus around it than it was to generate more of it. There's another difficulty with test cases, too, and that is that test cases are only good when your opponent loses. And the rights holders are smart enough and well-counseled enough to avoid, in general, being drawn into the sort of cases that they're most likely to lose. So there are real tactical problems with approaching this through the test case approach. We sincerely believe that the existence of this statement of best practices will operate as a successful deterrent to frivolous claims of copyright infringement brought by rights holders against filmmakers who are operating within the four corners of the statement. And in the unlikely, and I do think it is highly unlikely, event that any filmmaker operating within the four corners of the statement should be pursued by a rights holder, this statement will serve as a valuable source of information for the court that's called upon to decide that case. There is, however, another problem that your question identifies or pinpoints, and it's not so easily resolved, and that is, how can filmmakers get the advice that they need at the pre-production or production stages of their projects to make these principles real for them? Well, part of the answer, we hope, is that with the assistance of members of the project like Michael Donaldson, from whom you heard earlier, we're going to make the information that's in this statement as broadly available to the lawyers who work with documentary filmmakers as possible. And that includes, in our most recent grant, which has been funded and which will be going forward, the development of curricular modules on fair use and documentary filmmaking for use not only in film schools but in law schools as well. There exists today, and I'm happy to say that one of its outposts is here at the Washington College of Law, an ever-increasingly far-flung network of law school-based intellectual property law clinics, which offer free legal advice to creative people who have questions about a wide range of intellectual property topics. And we expect that clinical network, including the Glushko Samuelson intellectual property based here, to be available to filmmakers for the purposes that you described. There is also, in almost every place in the country, a network of dedicated lawyers who work without fee on a pro bono basis for creative clients through Volunteer Lawyers of the Arts and other similar organizations. We expect this statement to be an important document, an important resource document for those individuals as well. So it isn't going to be easy and it isn't going to be perfect, but we think that, in fact, there is a good likelihood that the existence of the statement is going to help filmmakers, working filmmakers, especially young filmmakers, come up, get better legal advice than they have perhaps always been able to receive in the past. There have always been exceptions to that generalization about legal advice, as Byron indicated in his remarks earlier. But we think it's a problem. We think the statement is going to help to address it.
My name is Arla Bowers. I'm a member of Women in Film and Video, and I'm also the Instructional Specialist for Media Arts in Montgomery County Public Schools. This coming Wednesday, your very own distinguished professor, Chris Palmer, is helping us out at AFI, and we're launching a new project called the Environmental Film Fest Project, where we're taking this year our two high schools that have environmental academies, and we're providing for them a three-part program. One, the launching of the program with Chris showing some of his documentaries and speaking to the students, and then having mentors come in and work with students who want to develop their own environmental films. Third, they'll come back and show those films. So with the launching on Wednesday, I've been doing a lot of research on copyright law and fair use and what's allowed, knowing that everything fell right here. I had to go out there and tell these kids what they could and couldn't do. I cannot thank you enough for this from all the K-12 educators out there. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, it's wonderful to hear that, because one of the things we've discovered is that one of the environments in which misinformation about this issue of copyright compliance sometimes is conveyed is, in fact, the K-12 classroom environment. The forces of the content industries, which are very, very powerful and very persuasive, have managed to achieve a good deal of penetration into the K-12 classroom, and it is good to know that this is going to be of value to you. And as Pat mentioned earlier, we're also going to be working with a lot of help from all of our friends in the filmmaking community on developing curriculum modules for use in the primary, secondary, and film school classrooms.
Yes, my name is Bernard Timberg, and I'm an independent an independent media scholar, and I've worked more in the university context, which is an easier case. At Iowa State, this was back in the 70s, I did what I used to call montage critique, but it might be called appropriationist media criticism, and a lot of people have been doing it, whatever they call it, in academia, and operating on various levels under the radar. The thing that comes to my mind now is that the Edward R. Murrow film that's out now, Good Night and Good Luck, when he says the fear is right here in the room. There's been that kind of fear for a long time, even as the copyright regime has gotten stricter. And I think this is wonderful, too. So add my accolade. One question I have is, just as they said to Edward R. Murrow, why didn't you speak out sooner? That question emerges to me, not that this isn't wonderful work, but why haven't people gotten together sooner on this? People like documentary filmmakers or teachers were supposed to be in some kind of forefront here. And that's not an accusation, it's a question. I start to compare this, and in fact I'm working on a project that I would be glad to have help on going into the history of fair use, and some of the pioneers, and some of the people who had the courage at an earlier stage. And if anyone, of course, this would make a wonderful documentary, if there's any documentary filmmaker who wants to take this on, but if there's anyone who has good examples of people who either on the legal, who stepped above the radar and said, no, what I'm doing is right, is fair use, and we're willing to be examples, I'd be very interested in that. So I'd just like to end by saying I really liked hearing fair use is a right, not a defense, and I think that could be a logo or slogan or whatever for this particular kind of advocacy, which I think is just clearly starting and catching fire. But also, kind of remembering that in the beginning of the civil rights movement, there was at the sit-in in Greensboro, and there's a wonderful film made on that called February 1, because it was February 1st, 1960. A white woman came up to the counter where the four students had their wildcat strike, and they didn't know what, because all this hostility was around them. She put her white glove on the hand of Franklin McCain, and she said, "Why didn't you do this sooner?" And that's kind of the feeling I have, and let's all move forward in an image rights movement if it can emerge. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have time for one more question, and you're on.
Actually, I had two quick questions. Right. One is, the length of copyright has been growing longer and longer, how that ties in with fair use. And the second is, for those involved in international distribution, or many of the networks buy things and think of international distribution, how does fair use vary across borders?
Important questions. The first answer, I think, is that the extension of copyright term, which we're all aware of, has made the kind of thing that we're talking about today all the more urgent. And in a sense, the part of the answer to Bernie's question may be that we didn't do this sooner because the urgency of the issue was not as great before, in a variety of ways, of which duration is only one, the intensity and scope of copyright protection began to increase so much in the United States. And that, I think, is the primary connection. The last question, which is a wonderful one to conclude on, is the international ramifications of this. As we all know, or maybe not, but we should know, fair use is a almost uniquely American institution. No other national law embodies anything quite like Section 107 of our Copyright Act. But, on the other hand, other national laws have other approaches to the definition of exemptions or exceptions to copyright in favor of creative activity. The fair dealing laws of other Commonwealth countries, the specific exemptions of continental Europe, and so on and so forth. There is work to be done on how to extend the learning of the statement to those jurisdictions, and that's work that we hope that we're going to be able to be a part of. But, and here I want to leave you with a last thought, there is no country of the world in which the climate of fear around copyright law is like that in the United States for one simple reason, and that is that almost everywhere else in the world, if one happens to make a wrong judgment about the use of material, a clip, for example, in a documentary film, the worst that can happen is that one may be ordered to pay a reasonable license fee for the clip used. It is only in the United States that copyright remedies, the damages that may be owed if and when an infringement finding is made, have become completely disconnected from actual harm or actual profit. So we're convinced that this problem, this chill on documentary practice, is one that exists first here, that it's a problem that has to be solved first here, and that solving it here, something we've taken a first step to do today, will eventually lead to its resolution worldwide.
I would grand plans. Well, I would like to invite you to discuss all of these grand plans at a reception, and the reception instructions are going to be given to you by Nishan Boston, the Assistant Director of the Center for Social Media.
Good afternoon, everyone. I would like the staff of the Center for Social Media to please stand, and the Washington College of Law to please stand. And these are the people who have done a heck of a job today. And we will lead you to the reception in the International Lounge, I understand, which is in the back of the cafeteria. So you see us, you see me, please follow us back there, and let's celebrate this wonderful occasion. Thank you.